Accession number 30419, reel 18.
That was something else again. I think we were about 30 yards apart, which is a and which meant we were dispersed. And you had to build a shelter rope between two trees using parachute silk and parachute cords and that kind of thing. Build yourself a hammock sort of affair, which is very difficult to do. And then you have to get in it and try and get some sleep. You've got all your clothes on, you don't take your clothes off. And you're sensible not to take your boots off as well, because they can get infested with ants and stuff. So the noises, there was a terrific, you get the hoots and the whistles and the croakings and all the, and rustlings, because everything comes out at night, and they're very interested to find out what these great blobby things swinging between the trees are. So they come and investigate you. And we knew there were rhino in the area, an elephant. There were still elephants in the jungle then. And goodness knows what else. And in the middle of the night, there was a most tremendous hullabaloo and crashing, and we thought it was a crashing in the jungle. There was this tremendous hullabaloo and shouting, and we all trembled in our... I trembled in my hammock. I don't know what anybody else was doing, and it quietened down. And then later on, there was another screaming from another hammock. Blue murder, as if someone was being throttled by a python. And then I stay shivering in my hammock, and then it quietened down. And I suppose must have got some fitful sleep, because I remember waking the next morning. And in the jungle, the sun doesn't come up. It's really quite magical, because it first of all, it hits the canopy, and it then comes down the trees. So the sun comes down to you, and when it gets down to you, it's got the most wonderful, comforting, warming, lightning. It's the end of the bloody night effect. You feel such an euphoria that you've got through that night in the jungle. And all the animals have gone away to mind their own business. And we got round the fire, was still going, and we got round the fire, and I don't know what we had for breakfast. Probably a few bits of chocolate and a cup of something hot. What was all that noise in the night then? And old Tom Snedden, my good chum and navigator, he'd hitched up this tent and tied himself in it, this hammock, and tied himself in it, and one end had given way, so he was suspended by his feet. So it wasn't a rhino at all, it was old Tom Snedden hanging from a tree and trying to get out of that. Imagine, in the middle of the night. And then the other rather sheepish squadron leader admitted that it was he who did the screaming, because he, one arm had gone to sleep round his neck like this. And he thought it was a python got him, because he woke himself up, couldn't feel his arm, and thought it had been a python. And screamed blue murder. So that was, there we are, that was our night in single man bashers. Now, we've been told that we were then going to go and do the escape and evasion bit. But fortunately, it was called off. And because the Indonesians were mounting landings. Can you mount a landing? I suppose you can. They were parachuting their guys into Malayan Peninsula, and also coming on a seaborne invasion. Not an invasion, incursions from Sumatra just across the way, because Indonesia was very, very close to Malaya and Singapore. So there were a lot of Indonesian guerrillas around. And so the Royal Air Force Regiment, who were the ones who was going to be hunting us, had other things to do. So, and also they thought it would be a bit of a shame if we got shot on suspicion of being an Indonesian incursion, guerrilla. So that was called off, and so we started to trudge out of the jungle. And on the way out, we had our first encounter with wildlife. You don't see the wildlife in the jungle. You're very lucky if you do. That this is why the natives are so clever. They're so stealthy, and they hunt with silent blowpipes, so they can get birds and monkeys. But we didn't catch a damn thing apart from those fish. I think one or two others had managed to catch on the other teams, but we were walking out, and the fizzy who was in charge of us said he reckoned he'd smelled a tiger. Ah, we said that's probably someone breaking wind, so we discounted it. But we came round on this track. By this time we were on a track walking through the scrub, and there sitting looking at us was a tiger. And I don't know whether tigers are terribly aggressive, but I'd never met a tiger on a track before. I don't think the fizzy had either, because he drew out his pistol. They'd taken our pistols away because of these Indonesian incursions. They thought they shouldn't, the fewer arms around, the better. But the fizzy still had a pistol, big Webley .38 revolver. And he pointed it at this tiger and fired, and it didn't go off. Thank goodness it didn't go off. It just clicked. Because the tiger, there was another roar, an answering roar from behind the bushes, and the tiger got up, looked at us disdainfully, turned round and went off to join its mate with the cubs. It was a male bay tiger. If there had been a pistol shot, well, number one, it would have been an awful shame to have slaughtered a tiger. Number two, it would have probably infuriated the beast because he'd had its family. So as long as we were still and not aggressive, he'd seen humans before. We were in a fairly populated part of the jungle. So that was our encounter. And fortunately, it all turned out all right. And we trekked out, absolute dishevelled rabble, and there, to the rendezvous where the trucks were going to pick us up, and there was the Magnolia ice cream man waiting for us.
That was your reward.
We fell round his neck and bought pineapple juice from him. But they knew where we were and when we were coming out. So it was a bit artificial, but by golly, it did give us a respect for the guys on the ground in Borneo. Imagine, Kathy, I mean, we were... My old flying suit that I was wearing for this exercise had rotted round me in 4 days. We were 3 nights in the jungle, so that means we were four and a half days. 1 day walking in, 1 night, 2 nights, 3 nights, 1 walking out. 4.5 days, nearly 5. And my clothes had rotted off me. It's the same for the guys in Borneo. Their kit only lasted a week. So if they didn't get an airdrop, their clothes were falling off. They could only take what they could carry. Trying to live off the jungle is impossible. So if they didn't get their helicopters coming in, or their us dropping into their DZ, it was very, very difficult for them. And they had to fight as well. They had to stalk the enemy, lay ambush for the enemy, assault the enemy. They used to ambush them in their boats on the rivers and shoot them up. They were fired at themselves. They often got caught by the Indonesians, and they had to carry all the equipment doing that as well. I would have found it impossible. So we had a great respect for the guys down there on the ground, 700 feet below us.
It's a very clever idea, actually, in terms of it actually helping you understand what they're doing.
And yes, it was, because you didn't, three services, you never saw, I didn't see a sailor all the time I was there, or saw some the Fleet Air Arm were there off their carriers, and they flew in and out of Changi. So we certainly saw Fleet Air Arm pilots, they were good guys.
So we talked about, you described that first run, the first drop zone run. Would you say it was that a fairly typical run? I mean, apart from the nerves and everything else, I wanted to get a sense of just a typical run and whether you feel we've actually covered that.
Yes, it was typical. We always had a load of... We always had one-ton containers, one or two to drop because they needed the fuel, and we used those mostly for fuel. We dropped harness packs at the smaller DZs, and that was mostly down Kuching. And we dropped rice and other soft goods at the airstrips. You can't drop it at 50 feet into a jungle clearing when the trees are 300 feet high. So that was the way we operated. We if we were dropping, I'll tell you one that wasn't typical.
I was going to say, were there any particularly memorable ones as well?
Well, out in Borneo, there were, Pensiangan was always memorable. Barrio was memorable because it was a magic place. Jawe, because it was such a god-awful journey getting there. The ones round south of Kuching because of the small arms fire. And the... and those others up in Sarawak, up in Sabah, around Pensiangan. There were two or three like Pensiangan where the terrain was particularly difficult. But it did become a kind of a rote, not routine, but it became by rote. And in 1965, we were running out of aeroplanes. They were taking a hell of a hammering. That upper door, where the parachute was being, with the static line, the parachute was putting strains on that upper door, which wasn't designed for. And the hydraulic system there were cracks developing. They had to be fixed. The airframes were taking a hell of a hammering in that sort of situation, with the rain. The rain gets everywhere. And so there was rust, there was corrosion. The Hastings had to go out of service. They were grounded because one crashed here in England at Abingdon. A bolt sheared on the tailplane and it crashed. So all the aeroplanes were grounded. So we had to work harder and harder and harder. And then in the last 6 months, because 215 Squadron was formed new, we all went out together. After 2 years, some started to go home. I went home after 2.5 years, and for that last 6 months, I was one of the most experienced co-pilots on the squadron and in demand. And I went on detachment after detachment after detachment to Kuching. And by this time, the New Zealanders had joined the fray. I had gone on... By the way, whilst all this was going on, we were flying to Hong Kong, we were flying to Thailand, to Bangkok, we were flying to Christmas Island, we were flying all over the Southeast Asian theatre. And I went for a month to Australia, which I'll tell you about in another reel, I think. So it was heavy work. A lot of heavy drinking too, and that's heavy work. I mean, it was going on and on and on and on and on. And then in 65, after we'd been to Australia, the Australians didn't want to join the conflict because Indonesia's their big next-door neighbour. Very difficult for them. But we went on a trip. I'll tell you about it now. Trying to remember what month it was. It was... I've got the operations record book for it. 26th of August, 1964. We flew off from Changi to go to Australia to take a party of senior officers from the Imperial Defence College. This was partly their training, and partly it was diplomatic to talk to the Australians and New Zealanders and tell them a bit about what was going on, how the operation was going. That was the line I was sold. And I went off with Andy Adams and Tom Snedden, and we went on the 26th of August, 64, and we came back on the 23rd of September. And we went the long way around to Australia, because we couldn't fly over Indonesia. We went for 2 hours up to Butterworth, which was an RAAF base up near Penang. 7 hours, 25 minutes to Cocos Island, which is a speck in the middle of the Indian Ocean. I did the landing there. The squadron commander's wife was with us, I remember, going to visit Australia. And the captain was taking photographs of Cocos Island, which is an idyllic tropical island. And I misread the charts, and I took twice as long over the landing as I needed to have done. I can't remember exactly how I did it, but I had this little approach diagram, and I was flying it, but I was going twice as far as I needed to go. Ooh, nobody noticed, except the squadron commander's wife, who said, "That landing took an awful long time, ain't it?" I don't blame her, it did take an awful long time. We then flew to Port Hedland, which is the top left-hand corner of Australia, 6 hours 45. So it took us 15 hours to get round to Australia. And then straight down to Pierce, which is in Perth. That was 3 hours 25 minutes of the most hair-raising flying I've ever done, because we got spring storms. September, the spring it is, isn't it?
Yes.
And terrific storms over that mountain range, and we got icing. And it was the first time I'd experienced icing in an aeroplane. The Argosy has de-icing boots, rubber things that inflate and flex on the wings and on the propellers and on the tailplane. It was sticking, notwithstanding. And it was coming off in great chunks from the propellers. And it dented the fuselage. I mean, it was quite, and we lost a lot of height. Fortunately, we got out of the icing before we hit the mountains. But it was a pretty hair-raising at night flight down to Pierce. We then went all around Australia and New Zealand. We went to Woomera, to Adelaide, to Canberra, to Sydney, Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch, back to Australia and Mount Isa. We went up to Papua New Guinea, to Port Moresby, over the Great Barrier Reef. We flew back to Darwin. And after a night in Darwin, we flew back home round Cocos. And we picked up the admirals and the generals and the air marshals in Perth, and we then took them to the towns. They didn't want to go and stay at the forces bases if they could avoid it, so we went into the civilian airports, except in New Zealand, where the civilian airport in Auckland was the RAF base. And so we saw downtown Perth and downtown Sydney, and it was a most wonderful, wonderful trip. We had some exciting moments. We flew up the Sounds down in the south of South Island, New Zealand. The
Marlborough
fjords.
Sounds. Yeah.
The what?
Marlborough Sounds.
Yes, and
Or the Milford Sound.
Milford Sound. Milford Sound. Yeah. That's right, Milford Sound. In Milford Sound, we had a hair-raising moment because the Admiral insisted on taking my seat. He was invited by the Captain, where he sat taking photographs. I could remember seeing the Captain taking photographs as well, so the airplane was flying itself up Milford Sound. And there was this wall of rock at the end. And the Captain, just in time, realised that, hey, the only way out was way we'd come. And so he did the first aerobatics and last I've ever done in Argosy, not the first and not the last, but the big wing over, it's called, and flew back. The Admiral thought it was fantastic. The Air Marshals were terrified. The Generals probably didn't notice. No, that's not correct. I mean, it was, and we flew back down Milford Sound. Tom Sneddon then had to guess which was the right way out, because Milford Sound goes round, there's several options. Fortunately, he guessed right, because we would never have climbed out. I can remember that. I remember flying round Mount Cook, Great Barrier Reef. Wonderful trip. And it obviously something did the trip, because Australia and New Zealand did join the conflict in early 65. And we got the New Zealanders with their Bristol freighters supply dropping out of Kuching. They were very brave men. The Bristol Frightener, they used to call it. It had a high wing, and once in the wind shears of Christchurch, the wings fell off. It had two Bristol engines, piston engines. It was as noisy as hell. I flew in one once. They did get hit by small arms fire because they were so slow. They had many a narrow escape, and they were wild in the mess. There was a book at the time written by J.P. Don Levy, which was called The Ginger Man, the hero of which was a tearaway called Sebastian Q. Dangerfield. And one of their flying officers was named, that was his nickname, Sebastian Q. Dangerfield. I don't know what it was, but they were always in trouble. Driving too fast if they drove, drinking too much, and they all drank. The station commander at Kuching was an Australian wing commander called Blue. I can't remember his second name. And the New Zealanders took against him, possibly just for being an Australian. But he had built a fish pond outside the officer's mess, which was a hazard, really, because it was a mosquito trap. So Sebastian Q. Dangerfield mounted a dam busters raid on it on the way back from Kuching Market with thunder flash explosives. Blew the thing to smithereens. Got into trouble for that. But they couldn't court-martial him for anything because he had to fly. We all had to fly. By this time, it was pretty intense. We had, it became by rote, except one trip, which was a training trip. When we flew with an MSP, medium stress platform. The Argosy was designed to take a heavy stress platform, and it had this 10,000 pounds more of floor, I told you about that, than it should have had. We never took a heavy stress platform, but we took medium stress platforms. These were two platforms linked together, which took up the whole of the freight cabin. And the idea was that you drop them both at once. And it would take a Land Rover and trailer. That was the standard load on a medium stress platform. And we were on a mission, training mission, out of Changi, preparing to drop them in Borneo. And they were dropped in Borneo. We dropped bulldozers. The Beverly would drop the bulldozers, and we would drop the bits, the blade for the bulldozer and everything else. And that morning, there had been a modification made to the the dinghy hatches. There were 232 men dinghies on top of the wing of the Argosy, in hatches on the wing, and they opened on the top. And there'd been a modification made. That morning, the first guy took off, his dinghy hatches came off. As he took off, the suction, the lift on the top of the wings, sucked the dinghy hatches off. Fell on the runway, air traffic control called him up, they took him off the runway, he came back and landed, no problem. They had another look at the modification, everything seemed all right, they thought it was a one-off. We took off about 10 o'clock in the morning with the medium stress platform, and it was always exciting going one of these things, because as it went out there were big changes in trim, and as it went you had to push, as it was going backwards, so you had to pull the stick back, but as soon as it went out you had to push the stick forward again, so it was always exciting procedure. So we had about a dozen soldiers alongside on the seats, and the dispatch party, four men and the quartermaster. And as we took off, there was a vibration started in the stick. Boss was flying it. And we thought, And the boss thought it was something to do with the elevators, but he couldn't quite be sure. And there was a fault going round the Argosys at the time where there was trouble with one of the connections in the elevators. So we wasn't life-threatening, but there was definite vibration. We got to about 1,000 feet, and the vibration turned into almost a loss of control. The stick was going every whichever way. The nose came up. The airplane was obviously in some trouble. And we didn't do anything. I didn't do it. I was sat there wondering what the hell was going on. The skipper says that he didn't do it, but the airplane went into a wing over. It did almost a loop, but coming round on a turn. The controls were unusable. The stick was all over the place. Nothing, and we were, before you could say knife, 100,000 pounds of aeroplane, dozen soldiers, Land Rover and trailer, the whole crew were pointing down at the South China Sea. And I can see it now. We were going vertically down from about 1,500 feet. Out of control. And I could see the rocks below the sea and the seaweed. I could see everything. I thought, oh, well, here we go then. We're going to die. We were all going to die. And just at that moment, as they say in the best dramas, something must have happened, because the captain got a bit of control. We were both on the stick hauling it out, and either the captain tells me he told the engineer to do it. I still believe the engineer did it. It was Howarth. He closed the throttles. I'm sure it was the engineer did it. He wasn't told, but he'd been in all sorts of situations. He closed the throttles. That must just have changed something in the airstream, that we just got back enough control. We were pointing back at the runway we were just taken off from, and we were going down. Nothing we could do about it, we were going down. And I was told to send out a mayday, and I sent the first mayday call that I've ever made and the last one. I called up on the approach frequency and said, mayday, 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 this is Mike Oscar Kilo Oscar Golf, whatever it was, we're at 1,000 feet, we're lost control, we're landing back on the runway we took off from, and that kind of thing. And they said, call local, which of course was a very sensible thing to do. So I switched to local frequency and made it again, mayday, 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 you're clear to land. But that was touch and go, because there were two buccaneers taking off towards us. And they were past the point of no return. And they went flashing past the wingtips the wrong way. They must have wondered what on earth was happening. And hot and sweaty,